Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
We don't have enough public financing capacity to meet our current maintenance and operational expenses, let alone think about new infrastructure like high-speed rail or what have you, building new airports, whatever. You know, we just have no capacity to even be able to think about those kinds of things right now.
That's Washington State Senator Bob Hasegawa talking about why he has been working so hard to create a state bank. They just don't have enough money to get their jobs done, and there's not much on the horizon that's going to change that prospect. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. Today, we take a look at how the need for government control of public wealth is driving the demand for public banks on two sides of the country, Washington State and West Virginia, where an exciting campaign has electrified voters into electoral action in this election year. You won't want to miss hearing the remarkable story that's springing forward from that challenged economic environment. But we have one of our own, of course, on the federal level, as the new coronavirus development has scared even the Federal Reserve. Here's Ellen.
Well, Ellen, here we are in a world that has a virus scare. Many people think it's overworked and people are getting much too upset about it, but it certainly has had big impacts, and people are taking precautions. Meanwhile, the market is doing its kind of knee-jerk reaction and plummeting into the face of what it fears will be some sort of an economic collapse, because markets will be disrupted and so forth. And then along comes the Federal Reserve and does something that seems to puzzle everyone, including you. Your new article speaks right to it. Fed strikes out again. Why is the Fed impotent in terms of responding to this crisis, or is that not what it's doing?
Well, so what it did was on February 24th, the World Health Organization said that it was time to prepare for a pandemic. Now, they don't want to call it a pandemic, I guess, because that sets in motion certain, you know, it's supposed to trigger certain responses, and they don't want to get all that official yet. But they're saying, you know, we should get equally nervous as if it was a pandemic, basically. And so the stock market did get quite nervous and dropped more than 10%, or the Dow dropped more than 10% on, you know, right after that, February 24th. And then, of course, this week it dropped again over oil, but that what I was writing about, I mean, I wrote my article before the oil drop. So the Fed last week responded by dropping the Fed funds rate by 0.5 percentage point, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it was only at 1.5%. So it basically dropped it by a third to 1%. And not only did that not help the stock market, the stock market actually sold off after that, because I guess the investors are thinking, well, if the Fed thinks it's a really big, you know, such a big deal that they have to lower the interest rate, then it must be a really big deal and we don't want to be in the market. So then the question is, why did they do it? And I saw on CNBC, there were some commentators who were getting all excited about it, and they said, hey, this is a supply problem. The reason that businesses are struggling right now is that their supply chains are cut, and like seriously cut. Like 938 out of Fortune 1000 companies have either their own supply chain includes products from China, or their secondary suppliers, you know, the people that they buy from, have to buy from China. So if you've got a break in the supply chain, then you can't build your car or whatever it is, or you can't. Pharmaceuticals is a really serious one, because 80% of our drugs come from China. So dropping the interest rate isn't going to really help. I mean, if they can borrow cheaply, it doesn't matter. It's not that they're lacking the funds. What they're lacking is the supply. So it seemed like an inappropriate response. But apparently the reason they did it, from various authorities say, the real problem was in the repo market. So once again, the repo market has been heavily oversubscribed, meaning there are a lot more people wanting to borrow there than the Fed had made available. And this is the Fed's own. There's a private repo market, and that was the one that collapsed in September, where interest rates shot up to 10%, where they should be under 2%, and they went way up. And this was because there were no lenders. Nobody wanted to lend, even though the borrowers were willing to pay quite a lot. And that was because, as I wrote in an earlier article, because they didn't trust the collateral. The repo market it's like a pawn shop. So you have some security, like a treasury, and you post that, and theoretically you sell it, and then the next day you buy it back. So if you've agreed to buy it back, obviously it's a loan, it's not a sale. But it's called a purchase and sale so that they can avoid bankruptcy. That's another whole story. I've written whole chapters on this in my latest book, Banking on the People. So it is complicated, but it's interesting to write about because it's just interesting to follow this whole saga of how insane it is. So that the lenders in the private repo market didn't want to lend because they don't trust this collateral. It may look like a treasury, but it may be a treasury that was acquired in a swap. Like you might have some dodgy collateral, like it used to be mortgage-backed securities, but now it's likely to be auto loans or something that they might have trouble collecting on. So you know you're not going to be able to post your auto loans in the repo market, so you use those in some sort of a swap to get something called good collateral, and then you post that collateral in the repo market. So there are different claims on this same collateral. So the lenders, largely like money market funds and banks, didn't want to lend because they knew that if the hedge funds had gotten in there, which they have, that they're very risky. They're highly leveraged, meaning they've got all kinds of risky collateral backing other kind of collateral, loans upon loans. So nobody wants to play in that market anymore, but it is where the banks now get their money. As we know, banks don't really lend their deposits. They create the money they lend on their books. So if the depositors come for their money, then, you know, they've got to get it from somewhere. So they borrow it, and that's how they make that whole system work. And they used to borrow in the Fed funds market from each other. But after 2008, they quit doing that because they didn't trust each other and they wanted collateral. So that's why they went into the repo market, and now they don't trust the repo market. But the whole idea that everybody has to borrow, nobody has the money, they have to borrow it. And the only reliable lender in town is the Federal Reserve itself, the deep pocket, which they are just, you know, obviously blatantly creating the money on their books. In other words, there's no money in this system. It's all just credit, and it's all just relying on other people's credit that may or may not be good, and then you don't trust it. And so that's why everybody's now turning to the Federal Reserve. And so the point of my whole article, what I'm trying to say here is that we're relying on the Fed, which its tools are not working. It doesn't help to lower the interest rate to 1% for banks. I thought of a good analogy. The repo market is where banks go for their short-term loans. Where poor people go for their short-term loans is payday lenders who are lending at 400%. So poor people, allegedly because they don't have collateral, are borrowing at 400%, and banks or hedge funds, which have very risky collateral. It's, you know, it's probably worse than a guy with a job who's putting his paycheck on the line. They get to borrow at 1%. So the system is clearly not good. Then what are the alternatives? We need to give the Fed some other tools, but the first thing we want to do before we do that is to turn it into a public utility to make sure they're using those tools for the benefit of the public. And the best models at the moment are China and Japan. China owns most of their banking assets are in publicly owned banks. So they can borrow from their own banks, and that's what they are doing. And in fact, when our stock market dropped by 10%, theirs went up by 10%, which is unbelievable considering they're the locus of this virus, so they're obviously the hardest hit, and yet their market is going up. Why? It's because they're pumping a huge amount of money into infrastructure, just like they did in 2008 when that whole market collapsed. So they're pumping all this money out there to build things, which will put people to work and, you know, get money flowing in the economy and get things back on track. And of course, they don't have supply problems. The problem they have right now is workers. The workers don't want to go to work because they're afraid they'll get sick. So anyway, we could follow China, but we don't have public banks like China does. Or we could follow Japan, where the Japanese banking laws are different from ours, even though they're supposedly also the Bank of Japan is independent of the government. In fact, under Japanese banking law, they're supposed to work together, the government and the central bank. So what Abe has done, Prime Minister Abe has made a deal with the Bank of Japan, like, we're going to fund all this infrastructure or all these programs, and we're going to fund it with bonds. We'll issue debt, you know, like everybody does, but we want you to buy the debt and don't sell it back and, you know, return the interest to us. So if you keep rolling over those loans, then it's basically free money. And even if you have to pay it back at some point, it's interest-free money instead of having to pay bondholders. So we could do that. Our government could partner with our central bank in the same way. It would take a little tweaking, but Congress can do it. They could tweak the laws because they created the laws in the first place. So all they would have to do is actually go back to things we have done, the things we did in the 1930s, where the central bank actually could work with the government. Or if these big banks collapse again, hopefully people are not going to tolerate another bailout. And so the alternative is to nationalize those big banks. And then we would have banks that we could access in the same way that China does. We could borrow from our own banks, which create the money on their books, as all banks do, and then use that for all those things that we need, infrastructure and many other things. We need to get our business. We need to become suppliers again and not just gamblers in the financial markets. So we need to build up our ability to create stuff, and we could do that, kickstart it through the government, and then whatever the loans create would pay back the loans. And if that didn't work, like in China, we could just carry these non-performing loans on their books, which would actually be good for the economy, as I've written before, because there's actually a gap between the money supply and the money available to repay it in the real economy, the consumer economy, not in the speculative economy, which is where all that extra money has gone, but it's not going into productivity and into the pockets of debtors who need to pay off their student loans, et cetera. It can all be fixed.
It can all be fixed. You say that China is planning to spend $500 billion in infrastructure in 2020. I mean, what are we operating here? I mean, China can do this. We can't do anything for our infrastructure, it seems.
Yeah, and that was just the start. That's what they've got lined up already this year. And they had, you know, it's much bigger plans that they were planning for the future.
Well, one of the cool aspects of this increased debt is that if it doesn't get paid back, it just gets carried on the books of the central bank. Well, might there be an analogy to what a state bank could do in terms of funding its own infrastructure needs, writing the debt onto its bank books, and then carrying it as necessary?
It could definitely, I mean, if we could get the Fed to lend to the state, why is it that a hedge fund can borrow at, well, say 1.5% in the private repo market, but a state can only borrow at, say, 3%. I mean, why can't we borrow at the same rate that the primary dealers can borrow? We've got the best collateral in the world, which is we've got a tax base. These cities aren't going away. Even if they can't balance their books, they've got taxpayers and they've got assets. I mean, we're very heavily collateralized. But it's just because they don't want the states, I'm speculating, but obviously they've always been rather prejudiced against the governments doing anything that looks like business or looks like we're actually being productive.
I think we're going to be coming to that point in the next couple of years as states begin to look at how they can monetize their equity. States are working out of a balance sheet that does not represent its true assets. assets for a state are considerable and could be interpreted in a lot of different ways that are not just things that could be turned immediately into money. So that kind of a balance sheet could perhaps change the landscape of how public banks consider how much lending they can create.
Yeah, and it seems to me, I know that this is what the big banks do, is they buy safe securities or whatever with their deposits that they get from us, cities, let's say, and then they turn around and use those securities as collateral in the repo market. And I think we could do that as a state bank. You're a bank. You could, like, if we could get California to move a good chunk of the Treasury's investment pool that's currently earning maybe 2% right now. I don't know. I haven't looked lately. Then we could pay them the 2%. I mean, buy the same securities that they're buying now, leave it on the books, but then you can use those securities as collateral in the repo market, and that's where you get your borrowed money that you then lend. Say we've got very strong, I mean, the state is not going away, the city is not going away, so it's not like a company that can actually go bankrupt and disappear.
So these new threads of investigation for how a public bank could work are going to be accelerating as more of them come forward. But later on in the program, we're talking with Stephen Smith, who is running for the governor of the state of West Virginia and has mobilized a remarkable statewide movement to reclaim the economy of West Virginia from the monopolistic interests that have been controlling it for so many years. And in the center of that campaign is a public bank.
Yeah, very promising, very exciting.
And then there's Washington State, who has been working on it, our friend Senator Bob Hasegawa, who is also on the program later on, talking to us about their rather frustrating efforts to get their state infrastructure bank off the ground due to pushback. And so we've got a lot to talk about this program, and I guess maybe we'd better get on with it, Ellen.
All right. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks so much.
What can happen when a grassroots movement springs up out of nothing? Ellen and I spoke with the leading candidate for governor of the state of West Virginia, Stephen Smith, a newcomer to electoral politics who is running much more than a gubernatorial candidacy. He's been part of creating a movement to transform the state of West Virginia. It's called West Virginia Can't Wait, calling into being an urgency for citizen action to overcome generations of monopoly control, which has exploited and extracted some of that state's most precious resources. As you might expect, the campaign includes a commitment to create a state-owned public bank. Ellen and I spoke with Stephen Smith, a community organizer who spent 20 years working directly on the problems of poverty and economic degradation at the hands of the money power in West Virginia.
We launched the campaign 14 months ago with the least amount of money and the least amount of people and the least amount of establishment support. And here we are 14 months later. I'm winning in the polls in the Democratic primary. We've raised more money than any other candidate, including our billionaire governor. We've done that by more than doubling the previous record for most small dollar donations in a governor's race in West Virginia ever. And perhaps most importantly, our campaign doesn't believe that one governor is the answer, that never in American history, never in West Virginia history, has one politician brought the kind of change we need. It has always come from the bottom up. And so from the beginning of the campaign, we said, we've got to go find more candidates. We've got to train hundreds, even thousands of volunteers. And the most exciting thing to me in our campaign is that I'm not running alone. There are now 92 candidates that we've recruited for offices up and down the ballot all across West Virginia, all of us promising not to take corporate cash, never to cross a picket line, never to hide from a debate. And we look like we actually represent the state of West Virginia. We represent the state's race and religious and class diversity, and that is an exciting thing. More than half of us are 40 years of age or younger. 14 of the 92 of us are educators who came up sort of in the teachers' strike movement of the last couple of years. So I could keep going, but suffice it to say, something really special is happening here, and it's awfully exciting to be a part of it.
Wow, that's great. So you've got a whole slate of people lined up. That's similar to what they've done in New York with the Sunshine Movement and the Justice Democrats, where, you know, the idea is to actually to sort of transform the whole party, you know, take over, sort of infiltrate, you could say, but take over the whole thing and not just, like you say, one person. So that's super.
The campaign is not just Smith for West Virginia. It's West Virginia Can't Wait. And out of this terrific aggregation and congregation of popular interest, you've created a document, which is very impressive. 100 pages, 32 separate plans, 250 or more policy recommendations. I really liked how you described winning the government back for the people. And quoting from this statement you've got, "In the government we win, surface owners and farmers will lead the DEP. Union workers and small business owners will lead the Department of Commerce. Foster parents, people with disabilities, veterans will run the Department of Health and Human Resources. Government will no longer be led by lobbyists and bureaucrats. It will be led by people like you and me." That's just a beautiful sentiment and, of course, high time. So a public bank is part of this architecture that you're putting together, isn't it?
It is. It is. And first, thank you for the kind words. And we think that the only way we get that kind of government, the one you just described, is to run a campaign that also reflects those values. And so the way we created this governing document, this platform, which includes the state bank, was spend an entire year of the campaign listening. And what that looked like was literally, we've now done 188 town halls, more than 800 visits to union halls and small businesses, the two or three sentences about regulating the work environment for nurses was written by nurses on a picket line, right? Much of the education plan was brainstormed by Marion County educators at a happy hour a year ago when they were saying, what would it look like if West Virginia were the best place in America to teach, and on and on and on. So it's not just that we have this idea that things should be different. It's that we feel a responsibility in the campaign to model what that governing would look like. And the document you're referring to is one where we actually drafted up a first draft of that document, sent it back out to all of our county and constituency teams who held 47 parties, 47 platform parties across the state, and sent us back more than 1,000 additional pieces of feedback, which got integrated and then ratified by our leadership. That in the final document that you're referring to, I did not have a vote. No one on our staff had a vote. It was the volunteers who have helped build this thing who went out and did 11,000 face-to-face conversations with their friends and neighbors. They were the ones that got to ratify the final version. And yes, bubbling up to the top, one of those 30-plus plans is a plan to institute a state bank for West Virginia.
This uprising, upwising, as one of our colleagues would say, comes from a strong West Virginia history of strength against corporate power.
Yeah, we're used to being exploited. That is the story of West Virginia history, is people outside of our state exploiting our wealth and goodwill and work, and us fighting back. You know, the bloodiest labor conflict in American history happened in the hills of West Virginia 100 years ago, when mine workers who were black and white and immigrant marched together to defend their right to organize and their right to a basic dignity. And the term redneck in West Virginia history comes from that fight, where mine workers, black, white, and immigrant marched together, 10,000 plus in West Virginia, wearing red bandanas around their necks, essentially as a common uniform in battle. And that kind of spirit we again saw 100 years later, just a couple of years ago, when it was West Virginia educators who sparked a nationwide teacher and school service personnel strike movement, in many cases wearing red bandanas to acknowledge that history. And the state bank fits perfectly into that narrative, because in West Virginia, if you want to fund an infrastructure project or start a small business or invest in local economic development in your county, almost certainly at some point along the way, you're going to have to get permission. You're going to have to beg for permission, beg for the ability to pay some Wall Street bank or other large financial institution for the right to develop your own community. And it should be no wonder that economic development in West Virginia has slowed and has been exploitative when we don't control our own capital. And that's what we're excited to do with this policy plan.
You've got such momentum. It's thrilling to see. How about the pushback? What kind of pushback are you getting from the moneyed private interests?
Yeah, they don't like what we're doing.
Imagine that.
This is the story, right, though, that I'm so tired of politicians who think that the way to win is to try to make your opponents happy. They're our opponents. They aren't supposed to like what we're doing. They're not supposed to be happy about it. If you've been robbing the people of West Virginia for the last 20, 50, 100 years, it's our job as the people to make sure you stop robbing us. And only way we're ever going to get anything close to a people's government or a state where most of our wealth stays here is if we fight it head on. And that's what we've signed up for. And, of course, what that means is candidates on both sides of the aisle who want to stop us. It means a new rumor every week about some group of out-of-state companies pooling their money together for attack ads. It means members of political establishment calling our 92 candidates on the phone every now and then suggesting they may not want to be a part of that West Virginia can't wait thing. And so that's what we're up against, and of course it is. That's what we signed up for. We think the only time in American history where things really change is precisely when a group of people come together and fight for something big and transformational.
So did you start this whole campaign yourself?
So a group of about 35 of us got together for the first time 2 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago, during the 2018 election cycle, to start posing this question. What would it look like? What would it take to run a campaign for governor that was primarily interested not in the election of one person, but in trying to win the closest thing our state or any state has had to a people's government? And we began asking that question. We did over the course of that first year, before the campaign went public, we did 800 face-to-face conversations with West Virginians asking, what do you think about this? What role would you want? Have you ever thought about running? How would we structure it? What kinds of issues might you be interested in? And it was from that process, along with additional collective big statewide strategy meetings every couple of months, that we crafted this infrastructure. And to the extent to which there is a person most responsible for this movement, it's our campaign manager, Katie Lauer, who's the architect of what we do, the person who keeps all of us marching in the same direction. And we got very lucky that the most talented organizer in the United States happens to live in West Virginia and have a history of bringing together community leaders and environmental advocates and working class people and coal miners. And it's her brilliance and big heart that help us keep marching in a direction that's larger than any one of ourselves.
And it must be pointed out that you don't have any quote-unquote political experience in terms of
well,
elected office.
Well, it depends on how you define political experience. I spent the last 20 years of my life fighting to get politicians and other powerful people to stop hurting working people. So I would argue that's political experience. But yes, I've never served in elected office before. That's true.
Well, you're absolutely right. That is the frontline political experience that makes all the difference. This is so much similar to the uprising in North Dakota back 100 years ago around creating the Nonpartisan League, you know, when they rose up and they took over the government and did their granary and then created the bank. Very, very, very similar, seems to me, that sentiment well represented. So the bank, when you look at the economy of West Virginia, dominant, of course, singular privately controlled industries, and you're seeing beyond that, really beyond an era of economic structure, because obviously you're looking at spreading around or distributing the wealth through enabling smaller businesses and families and grassroots nourishing. How do you see the bank playing that role?
Arguably, the most important question in West Virginia history is who owns West Virginia? And for as long as anyone can remember, the answer has been out-of-state interest. And I think a part of the story that isn't told enough is that that truth now extends far beyond just fossil fuel industries or land industries. It's almost every single industry in West Virginia has become an extractive industry where a handful of out-of-state, very large corporations have gotten rich off of exploiting the work and the communities in West Virginia. And the opportunity of a state bank is to put a thumb on the scale on the side of working people, on the side of small business, on the side of infrastructure, on the side of family farms, not just in a program-by-program way or project-by-project way or a handful of regulations here and there, but in the form of creating permanent and growing wealth that can stick up for those people, that the monopolization of the banking industry worldwide and in West Virginia as well is a particularly nefarious monopolization, right? Because they also control who gets to even have a shot at starting a business, who even gets a shot at being an economic actor. And as a result, small businesses and family farms and artists, the kinds of local entrepreneurs who actually create jobs at a faster rate and invest more of their money locally and act more responsibly, those actors are cheated by our current economic system. And a state bank is a powerful way to shift who the primary economic actors in society are away from out-of-state corporate boards and towards local entrepreneurs and farmers and union shops and artists and so on and so forth. And that fundamental balance of power, shifting that balance of power, we think is the most important thing a government can do, and a state bank allows us to do that in a way that has almost more potential than any other policy change we could make.
So it's amazing to me that you got that large group of people together, 92 people willing to run in a small state, relatively small compared to California, in 2 years without a lot of political experience, et cetera. People must be pretty angry there, pretty ready for change.
What you're getting at is exactly right, that West Virginians are not actually loyal to either party, because neither party at the state or national level has done much for us in a very long time. That you're absolutely right. The thing we're building in West Virginia, most of us are Democrats. A whole bunch of people are running for nonpartisan or independent offices, but you don't declare your party. But a handful of our people are Republican. One's a Libertarian, one's a Mountain Party person. That the thing we're doing is, in some ways, beyond partisan politics, because so many people in West Virginia rightly judge that neither political party has done a good enough job of sticking up for us, and that it's past time for us to stick up for ourselves. And of course, the most powerful example of this in recent history was the teacher and school service personnel strike in West Virginia, which for 9 days in 2018 taught every single one of us in West Virginia, reminded us that, in fact, the only way to change what's politically possible is for thousands of people to take collective, courageous action together. And I think that spirit has helped fuel our success, and that in many ways, sadly, it's rational for voters in West Virginia to give up on the system, or rational for potential candidates to give up on the system, because the system as it is currently constituted has done very little for the people of West Virginia in a very long time.
And that's great that you're like public, the Public Banking Institute and public banking generally is not left or right. I mean, we have people on both sides. I think probably more Democrats than Republicans, but we definitely have Republicans. North Dakota is Republican, and the Bank of North Dakota is our only 100-year-old state-owned bank in the country. So it definitely has Republican or conservative aspects to it. But what's cool about your campaign is that you've crossed party lines and you're going for what the people want, whether they're on the left or the right. I love that. That's right.
And what we find is that people actually aren't on the left or the right. That in West Virginia, in the country, if you go to D.C., if you go to Charleston, which is our capital, you see people playing out these elaborate red team versus blue team, millionaire versus millionaire battles. And as soon as you turn around and look at the rest of the state or the rest of the country and listen to people and their day-to-day experience, what you find is wide agreement. And, of course, there are people in our government and in the private sector who profit off of us convincing each other that we're each other's enemies. But on issue after issue, we find wide agreement. It's the most energizing and hopeful thing about the campaign is being on the trail. Just last night at one of our town halls, town hall number 188, a Trump voter who also is a major cannabis advocate told the story of losing a child to the opioid crisis and then refusing to take opioids after his own surgery and self-medicating on cannabis illegally because he didn't want to tarnish the memory of his child. And that story is not a Democratic story. It's not a Republican story. It's not an easily diced up or made-for-TV story, but it is actually quite common in its desire for simple, basic solutions that put people who are sick, people who are working, ahead of the interests of those who want to profit off of that work and that illness. And that's what we see over and over again is wide, fundamental agreement among the people of the state. It's just that the will of the people has been ignored for a very, very, very long time.
How did you manage to cross those lines? I mean, West Virginia Can't Wait is not a political party, right? It's
correct.
What do you call it?
We call it a movement to win a people's government in the state.
Yeah, that's what we need to do, a movement that's not a political party, because, you know, we really actually need another political party in the country, it seems like. But there's no chance. I mean, nobody can break through the strength of the Democrats and the Republicans. The Greens certainly never managed to do it. But to have a movement that covers both sides, that's great.
And really, we don't think it's both sides. We think it's, in some respects,
all sides.
Either side. Yeah. It's more like...
Oh, neither, okay.
It's the side of the people versus the elite. The fundamental battle in West Virginia and in the country right now is not red team versus blue team or left versus right. It's top versus bottom. It's the people making their own decisions or someone making decisions for the people.
Oh, that's great the way you just put that.
It really is. It's so inspiring, Stephen. And since I think we spoke last, you've picked up another 30 candidates down
yeah,
valley.
I think there's a pretty good chance we're going to hit 100 before this thing is done. So if anyone listening to this that you want to throw your hat in the ring, you've already signed up to be a candidate, you want to join the campaign, we'd welcome you. But I think another thing I'll say, too, is we also think this is very exciting and energizing. I appreciate your encouragement. And it's also true that we are playing a rigged game, that every day we can wake up, work 2, 3, 4 times as hard as our opponents. We've done far more town halls than all of our opponents combined. We have far more donors than all of our opponents combined. And yet still, we're going to run 2 very tight races because politics in America is a rigged game, and it is rigged against campaigns like ours. So for folks who are listening to this, I hope you find it inspiring. It inspires us every day to watch what people in West Virginia are doing and are capable of. We also need your help that no matter how hard we work or how inspiring we are or how right we do it, unless we build more political power, organized people, and organized money than our opponents, we will lose. And there's a very good chance we will lose, not because we're doing anything wrong, but almost in some respects because we're doing things the right way.
That's certainly happened before.
Yeah. Stephen, you're curious about the transformation of the land in West Virginia.
So the land of West Virginia is where our wealth comes from. So throughout our history, much of our land has been owned by outsiders. And still, in many counties in West Virginia, the majority of privately owned land is owned by people and companies not in West Virginia. And so we get exactly the economic development in those places you would expect from absentee landowners who are incentivized to do nothing with the land. The alternative is that there are actually lots of ways in which you can create economic value and wealth while also respecting and treasuring the land. And that as land and water become increasingly rare resources and assets worldwide, it is not hard to imagine West Virginia becoming a sort of haven for the rest of the world and for people who want a life that is not tarnished by big city living and the climate crisis as much. And so we can do that, and we're in talks with all kinds of folks, particularly local farmers and outdoors people and outdoor recreation folks, about how do we treat our land and water well so that we make West Virginia the best place in the world to live, not just the best place to visit.
Well, that's terrific. Just really wonderful, Stephen. Inspiring.
So inspiring.
Yeah, thank you for spreading the word. People can read any of our plans in black and white, including the public bank plan at wvcantwait.com. You can also make a donation there if you want to. We are within spitting distance. Joe Manchin, the U.S. Senator from West Virginia, is a former West Virginia governor, and he set the record for most number of donations ever in a governor's race at 9,098. Here we are 9 months away from the general election, and we are about to beat him. So maybe if you're listening to this, you are the person who will help us beat that record at wvcantwait.com.
Well, thanks once again, and we'll be paying attention.
Thank you so much for the work y'all are doing. It's absolutely true that while we heard the sentiment of some small business owners and economic development folks of wanting more access to capital, without the work that y'all are doing and people around the country are doing, we would not have been able to put this idea forward. So it's a great example of big thinkers and local small businesses and advocates, community leaders all coming together. So thank you for the work you're doing.
And thank you.
That's Stephen Smith, candidate for governor of West Virginia, whose campaign is actually a movement called West Virginia Can't Wait, as in teachers can't wait, coal miners can't wait, small businesses can't wait. You get the idea. Check out what their people's platform looks like at wvcantwait.com. As a relatively new public policy trend in the United States, public banking has been on a rapid rise for the past 10 years, which may seem like a long time for a rising trend. Proposing that cities, counties, and states take back control of their money and use it like the private banks do to expand affordable credit, invest in civic priorities instead of global speculations, saving a bundle, and even making money in the process, there's plenty of reason to see why it's a growing trend for legislative adoption. Ultimately, the decision to create a public bank comes down to a legislative action, which means that public officials are critical to the success of these initiatives. Prominent among all elected representatives around the country who have dared to propose a public bank is Washington State Senator Bob Hasegawa, a tireless champion for the public interest who sees these banks as ultimately essential for civic fiscal stability. Ellen and I talked with Senator Hasegawa about his long experience of working on this idea and what issues and roadblocks they confront.
Bob, you've had some of the longest experience in trying to start a public bank in America of anyone, closest to the power to do so, and have experienced all kinds of frustrations and intransigences, part of the power structures that you participate in. What's your sense of where this process of creating public banks is right now in the country, and what's it going to take?
Well, it's like any movement building. I was really encouraged by what the folk in LA have been able to accomplish, you know, with so much in just, gosh, it's just been a little over a year, hasn't it? And they were able to get their legislature to draft and pass a bill and get the governor to sign, giving them the ability to create their own public banks, although I'm not really sure the framework that they're establishing is the best one, you know, given that it requires FDIC insurance. But nonetheless, it's gaining so much traction just nationally.
Yeah, it wasn't just L.A. It was a network of 10 cities up and down California. You know, we'd been working with those cities for the last 10 years or so. So, you know, they all came together. We had a retreat, and they met at our retreat. You were there. So,
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, that was great.
So what are the big drivers in your mind about why public banks fit into this legislative agenda that's evolving here?
A couple of things. First off, raising new revenue without raising taxes. You know, that's like the holy grail of public finance, right? Especially in these constrained times. But also the ability to have capacity to finance the infrastructure we need. You know, we don't have enough public financing capacity to meet our current maintenance and operational expenses, let alone think about new infrastructure like high-speed rail or what have you, building new airports, whatever. You know, we just have no capacity to even be able to think about those kinds of things right now. So those are the two main things that I think drive.
Well, and of course, in cities like Seattle and around the country, affordable housing is a huge issue. And I know that, of course, in Seattle, wanting to get away from Wells in part because of the criminal behavior and the fossil fuel involvement and so forth. Do you see these as legislatively meaningful drivers?
Housing? Oh, absolutely. Except in and of itself, I don't think people are even thinking about public bank as a solution, because the frame for talking about building more housing have shifted from public housing to relying on developers to deal with our housing shortage. And developers are never going to have enough capacity to alleviate the supply problem. So the conversation has to focus on going back to the foundation of public housing, and then the question is, how do you finance public housing? And that's where the bank comes in.
In the state, you've got your side of the state, Seattle, Tacoma, Olympia, and all of that stuff, and then you've got out on the east side, you've got Spokane, and a lot of agriculture and other less intense urban situations. And it seems like there's a lot of resistance on that side of the state. Is that a misreading of your situation?
Yes, I think that is a misreading, because I do believe, I still believe that this is a bipartisan issue. I hate bipartisan, nonpartisan issue, because there's support amongst farmers, for instance. Farmers need more irrigation capacity, for instance. And we, you know, that means we've got to build reservoirs and canals and all of that, and we have no capacity for doing any of that right now. So there's been a lot of support for the public bank based on implementing phase two of Roosevelt's Columbia Basin project, which was never done. They completed phase one, obviously, but phase two is still hanging out there, and they see that as one of their top priority issues. Plus, you get the whole argument about libertarians bring forth about understanding and wanting independence from corporate domination. So it plays in rural parts of the state.
And yet your banking association has been a pretty constant barrier.
Oh, the Washington Bankers Association, yeah. Yeah, they don't like it. What can you say? Don't expect anything. Although, you know, we're trying to get the community bankers to understand that, or to at least have an open mind to how this will actually benefit them. So their solidarity with Wall Street banks is misplaced. And credit unions, too. Credit unions are actually neutral on the thing. I think that they should be supportive of it, because with that grown economy, it just opens up their customer base so much broader, but they're still just neutral on it rather than pro.
Well, from a national standpoint, how do you see public banking fitting into public policy evolution? Do you see it as a player, or is this going to be sort of a tangential side road?
Oh, that's a good question. But to me, it's fundamental. You know, if we're going to talk about real social change and equity and having capacity to grow our economy in an equitable fashion, you know, like being able to finance conversion to green energy, for instance, we have to have this conversation and develop a public bank to be able to finance all of these big projects. So I think it's a fundamental, whether it's core or tangential, I don't know, but it's definitely fundamental.
The money tends to be fairly fundamental, yeah. You've had a pretty robust Senate caucus for the public bank. Are you getting any support in the House at this point?
Yeah, I get a lot of individual support, but we haven't really done our organizing work on the House side yet. A lot of members keep coming up to me asking me from the House side how this project is going. And a lot of them want to sponsor the bill, actually.
Uh-huh.
So I think that there's lots of support, especially since that's where I originally developed the proposal.
Right.
Concept
yeah.
is well known.
The current study was supposed to focus on infrastructure, and you had kind of a new framework, as I was understanding it, a framework for cooperative bank that would unite municipalities or at least provide subscribing municipalities with access.
Yes.
To capital for that.
That's correct. But as I mentioned earlier, it will not be, the proposal will not be accepting public deposits of tax revenue. And I think that's a fundamental flaw, but others have said that it is not just what's necessary for them to vote for a public bank, but also that it's not an overcomable flaw.
Why is that? Are they're thinking that they need those revenues for their budget, and I mean they don't get it that they're already putting their revenues in some bank. It might as well be a public bank.
They don't want it to be in the public bank. They want to keep the account with whoever happens to be the Wall Street banker du jour for Washington State.
I just don't understand why that is. Why would they prefer a Wall Street bank over a public bank? They're afraid it's going to get lost? Or
that is the $64,000 question. I think it's just fear. You know, they fear of the unknown and untested in their mind, even though we all know it's well-tested globally, let alone just with North Dakota. But that fear factor has been the biggest problem, biggest obstacle, and the one that's most exploited by the detractors.
Yeah, I've read that too, that bureaucrats are very risk-averse. I mean, I think that's what's wrong with our whole system, that we don't let government go into business, so we don't let the government make any money on its own, which if they could, we wouldn't have to pay taxes, like in China. Their government owns businesses, and government is totally risk averse. So we're always the ones that are taking the 1% return or whatever, and then Wall Street is totally not risk averse, and they're gambling like crazy, and then the Fed bails them out. They know the Fed's going to bail them out. So the first thing we have to do is change people's mindset. That's what I do, writing, you know, just trying to throw some light on things that people just don't understand, how we're being taken advantage of. I mean, everybody says the pension funds are the patsies. They're always the ones getting the bad investments. But also, I think government in general.
Well, that's one thing that plays pretty well is when I talk about the return that our pension fund is getting through our state investment board, which is good for a pension and an investment board at roughly about 6.5% to 7% is their target, what they're trying to achieve. They don't always get that. Sometimes they exceed it, but the point is it's up and down. Whereas you look at North Dakota and it's steadily climbing. You know, what are they, last year they were at 18%?
17, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
Bob, the sources of money for this infrastructure bank, if it wasn't going to come from tax money, it would have to come from money that's granted through federal programs and other things. You've got a variety of sources of money, the Housing Trust Fund in the state, Community Economic Revitalization Board gives loans and grants, the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund has got money. Were these the sources for capitalization of the bank as it was initially worked up?
Yeah, all of those and more. They're all possibilities, right. But we'll have to wait to see what the business plan that the Evans School comes out with. But, you know, the money has to come from non-liquid funds, and that's the main argument that has been levied against us, is that they need all their money all the time. The general fund, it has money flowing in and out, you know, twice a day they make the deposits. So one of the things they're saying is that, well, you know, we don't have any money, but truth is there's little pots of money everywhere in state government. You know, all we need to do is assemble it. And plus the general fund, you know, yes, it goes up and down, but they have to make sure that there's a sufficient cushion so that it never goes in the red. But that cushion is excessively large right now. It's like a $2 billion or something like that. Even if we just took a sliver of that, $100 million to start a bank, that's conservatively $1 billion worth of lending capacity just right there, if you've got deposits to cover
right.
it.
Yeah, what they don't seem to be seeing is that they're only depositing their money. They're not investing it. They can pull it out at any time. That's the whole point of a bank. You put it in, you can pull it out at any time. And if the bank doesn't have the money, then they go to the repo market or they go to the Fed funds market. Or, you know, that's what all banks do.
Ours isn't even that liquid. Ours, that core capital cushion that I was talking about, is invested in short-term CDs that expire at different times, because they're hoping that we won't need to access more than, you know, what's in those CDs at any given check things.
Right.
To me, I'm to the point now where I'm thinking about maybe we should try an initiative of the people here, because you get a statewide platform and nothing seems to move legislators faster than an initiative of the people, which means that the legislature has lost control of the issue.
Well, it's always kind of an encouraging thing to threaten the legislators with the will of the people, with grassroots strength.
I've been doing these presentations all around the state, and I just get such positive support all around the state.
Well, Bob, thank you so much.
Thank you, Walt. Yeah. Ellen, thank you guys for all your perseverance on this topic, too. You've been like the anchor for all of us to hold on to so we don't drift too far astray. You guys are both
great
awesome.
Great talking to you, and good luck to you, and thank you for all your work.
That's Washington State Senator Bob Hasegawa. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.